We're looking now at the question of the place of dialogue in evangelism and apologetics, and this relates, I think, equally to the public square. And in a sense, what I'm trying to do, which I probably don't need to convince any of you of, is that dialogue is really part of apostolic Bible-based ministry. And it's the way that was modeled for us by the apostles, and that we should embrace it with an absolutely clear conscience. And that the way we tend to do evangelism through monologue from a height or distance without the opportunity for discussion is not actually the way the apostles did it or that Jesus did it. And so I'm sure most of you already be convinced of that, but this is looking at the biblical model of it. So I don't know if you like Gary Larson, if you've seen Gary Larson cartoons before, but this is a picture of communication going on. In this case, it's trans-species communication between a man and a dog. Incidentally, I wrote to Gary Larson and said, look, I find your cartoons very interesting. I use them to teach evangelism and apologetics. Would you have any problem with that? I've always worked on the principle that it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. Know what I mean? But I wanted to know, it wasn't going to make any difference to my behavior, but I wanted to know what he thought about it. So I got a reply from one of his people, and that he said that Mr. Larson did not want any of his cartoons used for religious purposes. So I took that as a Kiwi, as a green light. And so because they're very good illustrations. So, okay, so this is what we say to dogs. Okay, Ginger, I've had it. You stay out of the garbage. Understand, Ginger? Stay out of the garbage or else. What they hear. Blah, blah, Ginger, blah, 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 Ginger, blah, 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 blah. Now, there's a problem in communication here, isn't there? Now, what is the problem in communication? What's the man doing wrong? Well, yeah, possibly, but that's not the whole of it, because the dog is understanding some of what he's saying, isn't it? Do you know? Yes, the dog's not getting all the message, but look at the dog's body language. The dog is attentive, there's eye contact, he's alert, he's listening to his master, and he's getting part of the message, isn't he? So what part of the message is the dog getting?
What he wants to hear. His name.
Well, he probably wants to hear more, but he's certainly hearing his name, isn't he? And that's probably why he's engaging the master. So he's getting part of the message. But what mistake is the master making? He's using the words that the dog... So it's not that the dog doesn't speak English. It's just that he has a limited vocabulary. Right? So because he understands the word ginger, isn't he? That it refers to him. So he's using words that are not in the dog's vocabulary. Yeah? Is that right? So do we ever do that as Christians? And sometimes we use words that are in people's vocabulary, but they attach a different meaning to them as well. Apostolic evangelism. And if I say the prelude to this section is that we base a lot of this on the book of Acts. And the first thing we do is to go through the book of Acts, look at the apostolic sermons, and there are 9 altogether, 5 by Paul, 4 by Peter, I think it is. There's 9 sermons altogether in the book of Acts. And we get people to do a one-to-one role play where they've got 2 minutes to share the gospel with their friend, and then the other person does it, and then we get them to feedback what was mentioned. And then we look up one of those sermons in the book of Acts, and we ask the question, what is it in the gospel you heard that isn't in the apostles' presentation, and what's in the apostles' presentation that wasn't in the gospel you heard? And then we do this kind of analysis. So we're using the book of Acts at one level to say, you know, how do the apostles do it? We're pretty wise to follow their example. But in terms of content, okay? But now we're looking at the question of what was their methodology? How did the apostles go about their evangelism? And this is number one point, that they used language people understand. Did they ever get into trouble? Well, Acts 17, I think, is a great example where Paul goes into Athens, starts waxing lyrical about the unknown God, and what's the response of people? What is this babbler trying to say? The word means seed picker, you know, someone who's sort of put together a kind of potpourri of different ideas. It wasn't coherent to them. What is this babbler trying to say? And he goes on to say, they said this because Paul was talking about Jesus and the resurrection. Two Greek words, Jesus, Anastasis, that actually weren't in the vocabulary of these people because they're coming from a different worldview background. And so, of course, we all know they drag Paul along to the Areopagus. If you ever go to Athens, maybe some of you have been there, make sure, go up to the Acropolis, but you'll see the Areopagus, Areopagus, Mars Hill it means, and it's a big outcrop of rock, and this is where these academics and intellectuals used to sit up and have their discussions. That's where Paul went up, and if you go up to it, then at the bottom there's a great big brass plate, and it's got the whole of Acts 17 sermon printed out there in brass, and you can read it. It's if you like doing these things, standing where people have stood, and you know, you go stand up on the Areopagus anyway. So they take him to the Areopagus, and of course, Paul, with the brain the size of a small planet, is thinking as he goes along, you know, how am I going to communicate to these people? And then he preaches a sermon which doesn't use the word Jesus or resurrection in it, but he explains those things in words that people understand, and then we see the reaction that you would expect. So that's the first thing. Apostolic evangelism is in a language people understand. So it's making sure that we're using terms they do. Secondly, apostolic evangelism is in an environment in which the hearers feel comfortable. Now, how often do we drag people along to the classic guest service where there are all sorts of cultural things that make them very uncomfortable? So what Paul did was he went where the people were at. And we've got examples here, Acts 16, he's talking to the pagans in Lystra and Derbe. He's in the street where they're comfortable. Acts 17, he's talking to the academics at philosophers at Athens. He goes to the Areopagus, which is where they have these discussions. Acts 19, he's in Ephesus, and we're told he spends 2 years lecturing in the lecture hall of Tyrannus. And all of the people in Asia Minor heard the gospel as a result of that. Because they loved gathering in lecture halls and having discussions. In Acts 28, he's, of course, chained in Rome, and he's entertaining people in his own home, offering hospitality. And so it's another question to ask ourselves, are we engaging, are we crossing the boundaries to where people feel comfortable rather than taking them where we feel comfortable? And you know, you learn this when I was a medical student. If you want to have good discussions with your non-Christian friends, then you've got to go to the pub or the happy hour, and you know, or the sports ground, or you know, play a game of sports with them and afterwards chat. You find environments. And talking to Muslims, you go to the mosque or you go to a neutral area like a lecture theatre where they're comfortable. So that's the second thing: in a language they understand, an environment they feel comfortable. And then finally, with the opportunity for discussion. And I don't know if you've looked at the book of Acts like this, but if you open up Acts 17, and we just walk through it, in Thessalonica 17, verse 2, Paul, as his custom was, we read, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. So he's trying to reach Jews. So he goes to where they're comfortable, which is the synagogue, and that was his custom. But it was also his custom to reason with them from the scriptures over 3 days explaining. Now, the Greek word that's translated reason is the word dialegomai, from which comes our word, what? Dialogue. And dia means two, and log means word. So two-way exchange of words. He was just having a conversation with them. So this was his usual way of doing it. Acts 17:4, some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks. So as a result of this discussion, they changed their minds. If we go on in Athens now, 17:17, so he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. And if you stand up on the Areopagus, on that rock, and you look down, and there's this beautiful excavation of the old Athens township, and you know, you can see where the shops were and the marketplace and the streets where he must have had this discussion. But again, he wasn't standing on a street corner shouting and not engaging. He was actually just talking with people, asking questions, analyzing, and so on. And as you go on, Acts 18, verse 2 it is, Priscilla and Aquila talking about this. Sorry, verse 4, every Sabbath day he reasoned in the synagogue trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. If we turn over Apollos now in 18:27, he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. Or in 19, I've referred to already, in chapter 19, verse 9, he took the disciples with him and had discussions daily in the lecture hall of Tyrannus. And if you go through the book of Acts, you don't find most any occasion where Paul is just simply giving a long lecture. It's always, he's asking questions, he's making statements, he's listening, and so on. This is the normal way of doing it. You know, even on that one occasion where he spoke at such length, we hear that someone fell asleep and fell from a high window and had to be raised from the dead. The language there, it's still the language of discussion. And I know we've got some Libri people here. And this was the thing that Francis Schaeffer modeled so beautifully, that I remember hearing from a physician in London who'd met Francis Schaeffer for the first time when he came to Dublin and spoke in the university there. And there were just hundreds of people came, and he would just ask questions and respond and so on. And someone would ask a question and he'd say, what's your specialty? And they'd say, particle physics. And they'd say, well, and then he'd give them an illustration from particle physics or whatever. So, but the point I'm making is that this is apostolic, spirit-filled, modeled evangelism and engagement, and this is the way we did it. And so they did it. And so we have to be pretty foolish and maybe even a little arrogant if we don't do it the same way. And the point about dialogue is that it helps us to check their understanding, first of all. You know, you learn this as a doctor, especially when you're given bad news. You know, you say to the patient, so what is it that you've understood from what I've just told you? And they've got to feedback, and then you might correct a misunderstanding. You also understand what their objections are, because the preacher in the guest service, of course, what he's not aware of is what's happening in the mind of the listener, where all sorts of objections are coming up to bat away, to use the cricketing metaphor, the cricket bat in the hands of the atheist, who is batting away every argument with an objection which the preacher never hears, and so he's not addressing. And so the person goes away feeling fully justified in their unbelief because he's not being challenged. Well, of course, in dialogue, you can't get away with that. And then, most importantly, to answer their question. As well, the questions they're really asking rather than the ones we think they might have. So that's the nature of dialogue. The point is, if this is the way the apostles did it, then why do we not engage more, if we're honest with ourselves? And it comes down, I think, to fear. So what are we afraid of? What I'm trying to get at is, what might people think of us if they know we're Christians? How might they think of us? What would repel them about us, if they thought? If they think, you know, we're saying this is the truth and we believe it and we're going to heaven, and if you don't, these are the repercussions. What's a common, very common accusation that's given to Christians? Sorry?
Being judgmental.
Yeah, being judgmental or arrogant or whatever. So I hope you don't think this is too contrived, but okay, one I'd prepared earlier. But losing friends, and it really, it's a genuine risk, isn't it? And there will be people, and the relationship will change after that. You know, when my grandfather was dying of cancer, and he'd had a faith earlier, and I was in England, and I really felt very, loved him very much, and I wanted to. I knew the only way I could speak to him was through a letter, but what I hesitated in sending it, because I thought, well, what if Grandad doesn't like me as a result of me, you know, spelling it all out and so on. And then I thought, you know what? I'm more concerned about what my Grandad thinks of me than I am about his eternal destiny. And I came up short and thought, how much do I really love my grandfather? You know, anyway, long story, but we had a long correspondence, and he came to faith before death, and that was part of the ingredient of it. Was it is losing friends is a risk, but Jesus said we would lose some friends. But actually, if we're acting with integrity and concern and love, then a lot of people will find our friends, even if they're not convinced. They will respect us more for it, and it will deepen the friendship. And the friendship will reach a more mature level because it's a friendship that can cope with disagreement. You know, not this sort of, unless you agree with everything I believe, you can't be my friend. That's what the immature person says. And then number two is appearing judgmental. But of course, that turns the whole gospel on its head, because we're not saying we're good people, you're bad people, we're going to heaven, you're not. No, it's the whole thing that we recognize we're bad people and that we need God's forgiveness. So that's really an issue of properly explaining the gospel. But this third question is not knowing how to answer their questions. And of course, there must be, you know, that's the thing, is there are hundreds and hundreds of questions that people can ask you, aren't there? I mean, I'm going to push on, but so what are these questions we're afraid of being asked? Well, I'm going to push on for reasons of time, but what I'm trying to demonstrate with you, in words you understand, in an environment where you feel comfortable, and in the context of dialogue, if you like, is that there aren't hundreds of questions. You've struggled to come up with half a dozen or so, and the same question has come up in different guises, that, you know, you can reduce it down to the same question. Now, when I was a student, there was a book called How to Give Away Your Faith by a guy called Paul Little, and he used to talk about the seven deadly questions, and these were, if you're a student in the 1970s, these were the questions that always came up, and many of them will come up today as well. And is Christ the only way to God? That's the other religion things. And none of you mentioned this, but there are different guises of, is the Bible full of errors? It might be a Muslim asking you about how the Bible's been changed, or it might be related to creation, evolution. This is another one. You're only a Christian because of the way you brought up. You know, you're only a Christian because of the benefits you get from this. I can see the real advantage, what's led you to be a Christian. Often quite an aggressive question. Miracles. What about those who've never heard the gospel? doing dialogue evangelism, this virtue always comes up. And I think, why do the innocent suffer? Won't a good moral life get me to heaven? So these were poor little seven deadlies. And I can tell you my experience, having done many, many dialogue suppers and evangelistic, you know, stand-up evangelist meetings with atheist students, is that these always come up. And sometimes they're different from the questions you get from Christians. And it's only the order in which they come up that is different. Now, there was a chap called Paul Weston in the UK, and he went out in the UK context, and he flipped the question around. So he asked people, why don't you believe in Christianity? And he got six answers. There's no proof. How often do you hear atheists saying, there's no evidence? This is the Richard Dawkins line. As John Lennox said, the people who say there's no evidence are generally those who are also not interested in looking at the evidence as well. There's more than that. Christianity is irrelevant. Well, of course it is if you have a worldview which excludes it. I've never really thought about it. Isn't that astounding? But in a post-Christian society, many people have dismissed Christianity without even examining it properly. A very low level of biblical literacy. This is the question of hypocrisy. The biggest obstacle is the church. There's so much suffering, so there's a repeat on that one. And then the only way to God, so the pluralism question again. So 7 plus 6, you know, maybe there's 7 questions, maybe there's slightly more than that. And of course, they vary across cultures. So here are the 21st century British objections. And when we're training students in this stuff, of course, there are some questions that come up now in our cultural context that never came up when I was a student. And they are, God's a moral monster. I have a blog, and I like putting provocative questions out, addressing provocative questions in it, or putting them out on Twitter. And so I wrote a blog on the slaughter of the Amorites. Was it justified? See? And then I put a tweet out saying, the slaughter of the Amorites, was it justified? Hashtag evolution, hashtag atheism, hashtag, at Richard Dawkins. So I sent it to Richard Dawkins. Anyway, so Richard, it's the only communication Richard and I have ever had, but Richard just tweeted it to 100,000 of his followers, and then a whole flock of atheistic trolls descended upon my website and so on, and wrote a whole lot of things that don't bear repeating. But you see, I wasn't bothered at the least. I was just trying to provoke and engage, and if some of them read what I had to say, it might be helpful. So, but that's very prominent coming from the new atheists, that sexuality, massive, isn't it? And particularly the LGBT and now the transgender stuff. You're never, when I worked for CMF, I was there for 27 years, the first 23 years, I never once got asked to talk about transgender, not once. And the last 4 years, 50% of all the talks I gave were about transgender. And it wasn't because I was going and looking for opportunities, that's what people wanted to ask. And so the point is, cultures can change. Ethics, especially around abortion, euthanasia, so on, sexuality, transsexuality, abortion, there's a huge divide now. We don't live in a society where the majority of non-Christians have the same view we do about those things. It's not because we've changed our view, it's because society shifted. The intolerance of Christianity, that, you know, judgmental position. And, I'm saying we live in a kind of Romans 1 society where there's been these three exchanges we talked about. So there are different questions. And if you go into different cultural contexts, and we use the same material, starting with worldviews, with doctors all over the world, and they're from different cultural contexts. So if, for example, you're talking to Muslims, then the questions will be different because they're theists, But there are, in just the same way, there's seven deadly questions from Muslims. Hasn't your Bible been corrupted? Always comes up. Your Bible's been changed. You know, they'll say, what version of the Bible is that you've got? And you know, you're onto this question. What about the predictions of Muhammad in the Bible? The prophet, it's Deuteronomy 18 and the Paraclete passages in John. How can you worship three gods? Because associating anything with God is anathema to Muslims. Why is the need for the cross? Why do you need atonement? If Allah wants to forgive sins, he does it. It doesn't cost him anything. How could God allow his son to die? Or building on that, how could God actually die? So Jesus was God, yes? And Jesus died, yes? And how long was Jesus dead for? 3 days. So who was running the world when God was dead? You know? Very common with Muslims. And then the Quran, you know, we believe in it because it's clearly God's word because of the scientific insights that it has, like the explanation of how embryos develop in the womb. And how can Christianity be true when the West is so corrupt? So it's the idea of associating Christianity with the Western world. The Western world is corrupt, so therefore it must be Christianity that's made it corrupt. Now, if you've talked with Muslims, and it's very easy to talk with Muslims, you will know all these questions. If you haven't engaged with Muslims, some of this might be new to you. But the point I'm trying to make here is that one of our greatest fears is the questions we'll be asked. But there are not hundreds of questions in any cultural context. There are a small number, maybe 7, maybe 10, maybe 12 or whatever, but there's a limited number. And if you were about to sit a very important examination and you had a dream, let's say a couple of weeks before, and it had that kind of quality that you knew it was a prophetic dream in which you saw the exam paper and remember the questions and woke up, and what's the first thing you're going to do in preparation for that exam in 2 weeks away where you know what the questions are? What are you going to do? Yeah, you're going to write down the questions and research the brief on each of those, because passing exams is really important. But what's the more important exam, the exam that gets us our university degree or something, or is it that big exam at the end of life called the judgment, where everybody stands up before God and there are difficult questions being asked? Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of playing with you and so on, because you all know this. But the point is, we're scared of questions, but there are a limited number of questions, and it's not a big job to be able to give good answers to those questions. And so as part of our Christian stewardship, especially people who are engaged in the public square, we need to know what the questions are and need to be able to give answers to them. And so if we're doing this, if we had a lot more time to do this course, that the way we do it is that it becomes increasingly interactive throughout the day, and then we spend the second half of it all in dialogue and role play debating the questions. And you know, I'll play the devil's advocate, bring three people up and say, look, we're going to talk about why God allows suffering. I'm the non-Christian, you're the Christians, you know, try and persuade me. And then I'll take them through the different angles of that, and then we stop and talk about it. So it's, I think media is very much the same. A role play is a good way of preparing for it. And it's like any learned skill. The more you do, the better you get at it, and the more articulate become, and you learn what arguments don't work and what do, and so on. Okay, so that's what we would do. And let's just crack on through the last little module here. I told you about Paul Weston, who goes into the streets in Britain and says, why don't you believe in God? But let's turn it around. And if someone were to ask you, at this time when not many people do ask questions, but if they were to ask you, why do you believe in God? They're genuinely interested. Why do you believe in God? Then what answers could you give to that? What broad categories of answers? What things might you talk about? Beauty and design in the natural order is a great argument, and it's a biblical argument. Day after day, the universe pours forth speech. What does Paul say in Romans? That the power of God has been clearly seen in the things that are made. It is powerful. Even Richard Dawkins will tell you, well, yes, the world does have absolutely the appearance of being designed, but it just hasn't. It just looks like that. Inner awareness. Just on design, a good friend of mine was at a camp for young teenagers having a discussion about whether God existed or not. And he said, look, he wasn't getting anywhere. It was late at night. He said, come with me, let's go outside. And they just lay down on the ground and looked up at the stars. And they just looked for a while. And after a few minutes, the boy said, yeah, there's a God, all right. You know? And it might be something that resonates more with us. Inner awareness, but personal experience, testimony, absolutely. That's a powerful argument. And the apostles, there's one occasion where Paul, you know, is at one of his sermons, he's up with his own countrymen accusing him. And what does he do? He just tells the story of his conversion. Very powerful. And then God's revelation in Jesus Christ, that why do we know about God? Well, not just because of his dealings with the Jewish people, but most perfectly because of his revelation in Christ. We look at the person of Christ, the words he spoke, the claims he made, the miracles he performed, specifically his death and resurrection, and the fact that he was all predicted in the Old Testament prophets and fulfilled exactly all of those things, God's revelation. So what I'm arguing here with you in the context of dialogue, in a comfortable environment with the opportunity for discussion, hopefully, is that there are three main lines, and they're all biblical lines that you can take. And they're all legitimate and spirit-filled and apostolic. But now I'm asking you, what questions are you putting on the agenda for discussion? If you go down the line of creation and the wonderful world around us, what questions, which of the seven deadly questions are you immediately putting on the agenda? The point is, you put questions on the agenda by the way you answer the question. And you know, the trick in media is you lead people to ask the questions that you want to answer. And in conversation as well, the way we answer questions puts things on the agenda that we might not want to talk about. I wish I'd known this when I was a student, because I think I wasted hours and hours and hours talking about things like creation evolution. If I'd handled the discussions better, I got quite good at doing it, but I think if I'd cut to the chase more, I could have had some more profitable conversations with some of my friends. If you go for experience as an argument, what questions are they going to come back to you with? What do you put on the agenda? Now, my life has wonderfully changed since I was a Christian. You should have seen me before, and now I have this wonderful relationship with God, and he fills me with joy, and I've got meaning and purpose in my life, and so on. What are they going to say?
They say, well, what's good for you is not good for me.
Yeah. Or in Australia, they say, each one to his own. And in New Zealand, they say, yeah, each one to his own, mate. That's, yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Well, then why is it that you'll start sometimes too? Like, you'll come back and you have so much joy today.
Yeah, and they might. You say, well, that's just the reality of human existence. And I'm not saying Christianity solves all your problems, but what I'm saying is that, you know, I really experience God as a living entity in my life. There's a relationship there. Maybe it's more like a sort of, a struggling relationship because I'm imperfect, but there's real relationship there. I've experienced it. What are they going to say?
What about other religions?
Yeah, I've got a Hindu friend who talks about the same way as you, or a Muslim. You know, what about all these other religions? They're equally. What else might they say? Yeah, so that's a variant on one of the questions that we raised before, but that's right. So you put questions on the agenda. What about all the other religions? It's all psychological. You know, the fact that you feel good doesn't make it true. Or relativism, the nature of morals. This is the thing that you were raising. You know, what's true for you is, yeah, that's fine. What's true is what's true for you. Personally, I'm into Zen Buddhism or whatever. If you go for Jesus Christ and his claims, teaching, miracles, death and resurrection, what are you putting on the agenda to talk about? Yes, that, and a Muslim may well ask you that. And the Muslim will go on to say, also, he was just a prophet. And the reason you think that is because the reason you think he's God is because, what would a Muslim say?
Scripture has been corrupted.
Yeah. The Bible's been changed. And so this comes down to the question of the reliability of the gospel records. You know, was he just a legend? Did Jesus exist anyway? How do we know what was said was recorded by eyewitnesses? How do we know it was reliably passed down verbally or written form? How do you know that, you know, and this is the big one for the Muslims, what version of the Bible are you using? Oh, well, we all know that the Injil, the gospel given to Jesus, was written in Aramaic. Your Bible's in Greek. So it's clearly to start a translation. So these are the lines of argument and the questions you put on the agenda. But if I was to say to you, well, if you had 5 minutes to talk to a friend who perhaps even surprisingly has asked you, well, you know, Nola, I've always, you know, I respect you as a person. I don't have much respect for Christianity, but, you know, you seem to be a nice person and intelligent, so why is it that you believe something so wacky? Which of those three answers, what would you most like to spend the next 5 minutes talking about, Nola? Would it be creation, experience, or the person of Jesus Christ? But I think actually what we really want to talk about is Jesus, because that's what the gospel is all about. And so we want to lead people to Jesus. And if we get the opportunity to talk about why we're believers, then that's the best line to go to. You can't avoid other questions, but if you can lead a discussion to that, what did Peter say when Jesus said to him, will you also go away after the Bread of Life sermon? He said, well, to where would we go? We have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. You know, we're with you, whatever that means. And so if we want to talk about Jesus, we've got to construct our conversations in a way that it leads us on. There was a chap in our, a guy I worked with actually when I was training, who was a hematologist, so he's experienced in blood disorders. And when you sit your final exam in medicine at the end of medical school, part of it is you've got to examine a patient and find that what the abnormalities are, and then they have a discussion about, you know, what the diagnosis might be and so on and so on. Anyway, this guy had spent his entire project in the sixth year writing on an extremely rare blood condition, which many doctors have not heard of, including, of course, most surgeons. And it was a condition called hairy cell leukemia, you see, very rare form of blood cancer. And so he had a patient to examine, and the only sign that he could detect was an enlarged spleen. And so the examiner said, so You know, the first question is always going to be, okay, enlarged spleen. So what are the causes of an enlarged spleen, young man? And so he went through the long list of leukemias and myeloproliferative disorders and lymphomas and so on, and then he got to the rarer list at the end, and then there are other rarer causes like da 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 da, da and hairy cell leukemia. Hairy cell, like H, like hairy, hairy cell leukemia. So he says, like hairy cell leukemia. And now you think, these two examiners, they've been talking to students all day, they're absolutely bored to death, and they're suddenly sort of waking up. And what will the next question from the examiners be? Tell me about... Yeah. And so this guy's 5 minutes into a half-hour viva, and he gets thrown. It's like to use Charlie's analogy. Charlie, you're there at the crease, you know, and you're on 96 not out, and the ball comes down, and it's like, and you're seeing it not like a cricket ball, but like a beach ball, because your eyes are in. So and it comes slowly, and it bounces up, and you know, you think, oh, wonderful, this is my century, you know, and you hit it over the boundary. And it was like that, that he was throwing this dream ball. And so this is 5 minutes into a 30-minute viva. And I can tell you that at the end of those 30 minutes, he was still talking about hairy cell leukemia. And of course, he won the prize in the exam. So you get my point. Let's ask lots of questions, but when we get asked questions, let's answer them in a way that leads to the kind of things that we're really wanting to talk about. Let's cut to the chase in doing that.